So, yeah, okay, I was playing it up a little bit, but it is true that it's been a little bit of a weird kind of day. But fortunately, I managed to make something of this because I like to start out the show with a little philosophy. So we'll have a chance to do a little philosophy because there's nothing for enlightenment like a little pain and suffering. So, yes, I do not have a guest for today, unfortunately. And also, Bianca Della Sofia informed me yesterday that she is very sick and she will not be joining the show today. And she sent us this this image, I guess, either to generate sympathy or to prove that she really is sick. I'm not entirely sure which one. But either way, she also asked me to read this message from her to all of her adoring fans. So here it is. She says, "Dear fans, sorry for my absence, since I know my beautiful shiny faces makes all you very happy. But I just wanted to say I was right about the aliens in the ocean and the mermaids in the sky. Can't wait to see you all. So sorry my kidneys attacked me. But it's not my fault. If anyone wants to donate money for new kidneys to my GoFundMe, I will definitely use it for a nose job. Thank you in advance. Feebly and fabulously, Bianca Della Sofia." So, hopefully all of her fans and Public Citizen, thank you for your good wishes there. I'm sure when she hears Godspeed, she'll launch into some sort of monologue about the nature of God or the gods or whatever. But that's not really, it's really neither here nor there. We will hopefully see her back next week, and I know we're all excited about that possibility. In the meantime, I did manage to turn, because I woke up this morning and I was like, man, no guest, no Bianca. Am I even going to do a show today? Like, I work all week on these things, and I really do enjoy doing this. Like, the first time that I got on here and I pressed the start streaming now button, I feel like the universe, the spoke to me, the clouds opened up, and whatever God there is in heaven came down and said, "You have found your calling. This is it." And so to come to the end of a week of putting stuff together and being really excited to find that, oh man, half the show is missing, was very disappointing and very frustrating. And this morning I was ready to just be depressed and not even do this and just go, "Ah, this sucks. I'll do it next week." But first of all, I knew that if I missed a week of doing this, I would not feel good all week. It would just be like, not perfectionism, not the crush of guilt and shame, but rather I missed an opportunity to do something really cool. But it also turned into, because I was reading Socrates last night, specifically I was reading from his Apology, which, if you're at all familiar with it, is hardly apologetic in any sense of the word that we would use today. Socrates' apology, and actually the word apology itself, really means defense. So Socrates got up and made his defense at his trial. And he was being tried for corrupting the youth and introducing strange gods. So kind of like, I don't know, being canceled for being politically incorrect. He was like the first guy to get, the first victim of cancel culture ever, 399 BC, Socrates, before a literal Athenian mob. And they all expected him to get up there and plead for his life. But instead of doing that, he got up there and told them that he was the greatest thing that had ever happened to Athens, that there was nothing they could do to make him change his ways, and then said, "Hey, if you're going to kill me, then do it. Bring it on," basically. And so they did. They brought it on and they killed him. And it turned into a very wonderful, frankly, group of four dialogues by Plato that I'm going to be talking about today. So Clandestine, hello, Clandestine Blaze says, "I like guns and money. Interesting painting. And what's with the typewriter?" I'm not sure what's with it. It is my typewriter that I found in an antique store about 5-6 years ago. And got it all kind of fixed up, got some new ribbons for it, and I do, whenever I have the opportunity, use the typewriter. Not that the modern world offers much opportunity to use a typewriter. And the painting is actually Plato's Academy by, I forget which Renaissance painter, but the two guys in the middle there are Plato and Aristotle, and the guy on the stairs laying down is Diogenes. So, and then I find my thoughts to be more evil when I use a keyboard to express myself. Well, then I am concerned because I know that you are using a keyboard to talk to me right now. I actually learned to type on an Olivetti typewriter at the age of 10 because I was a weird homeschooled kid, and that's the kind of stuff that we do. And I'll tell you this, you get really fast at typing on a computer keyboard when you learn on a typewriter keyboard. But anyway, the typewriter is cool, but the typewriter is not what I'm here to talk about. What I'm here to talk about is whether or not we can really pursue the absence of pain, whether or not we can avoid suffering, right? So I want to show this. This is a from Socrates, actually, and here it is. This is him talking to his accusers, and he's on trial for corrupting the youth. He is up in front of the mob, and he is on trial for his life. And they've said, by the way, all of his friends said beforehand, because one of the things you could do in the Athenian court system was if you were condemned to death, you could come back and say, well, actually, instead of killing me, why don't you do this? And you're supposed to propose some alternative punishment. And if your proposed punishment was acceptable to the mob, they would let you go. So this is what he said. So, yes, he was a bit of a troll, clandestine, but he was a very philosophical troll. And we might say that he was a troll for all the right reasons, though certainly we can understand why they killed him. Because when he was on trial for his life and everyone thought he was going to get up and grovel and say, I'm sorry, please don't kill me, this is what he said. He said, if you kill me, you will harm yourselves more than you will harm me. Meletus and Danitus, his accusers, cannot harm me, for it is not in the nature of things that a bad man can harm a good man. You can kill me, drive me into exile, take away my rights, and you can imagine that I have suffered harm thereby. But I do not agree, for the evil you are doing of unjustly taking another man's life is greater by far. Now, what does he really mean by this? Because they were talking about driving him out of Athens. They were talking about taking away his civil rights. They were talking about doing all sorts of crazy things to him. Things that when most of us, if we experienced this, would probably be groveling. Most of us probably would do what Socrates laughed at other people for doing, which was to bring up their children in front of the court and say, please, my children, what about my children? They'll be left fatherless if you kill me. And Socrates said, bring it on. I don't care. And no public citizen. Well, okay. Let me take that back. The Greeks believed that the dead went to Hades, which was not a pleasant place. A very few of the dead, the virtuous, honorable, the great ones, went to the Greek version of Valhalla, which would be the Isles of the Blessed. And Socrates talks about this a little bit in the Crito and Phaedo later on. So public citizen says, video or it didn't happen. I'll do my best, but no promises. But did these Greeks believe in reincarnation? No, but Socrates actually talked about this right before he drank the hemlock. And he talked about being afraid of death is nonsense. That's what he said. He said to be afraid of death is ignorance, because his whole thing was, I am the wisest of all people because I, unlike everyone else, know that I don't know anything. And so I don't know what happens after death. So it's either something awesome, something horrible, nothing, maybe something we can't understand. And in most of the possible cases of things that it could possibly be, it's nothing to be afraid of. So why be afraid? On the other hand, if it is something terrible, being afraid of it would be like being afraid when the enemy charges at you, which is dishonorable, and no real man would ever do such a thing. So there's no reason to be afraid of death. And furthermore, there's no reason to be afraid of suffering, because honor, money, happiness, pleasure, these things don't matter. All that matters is the integrity of my soul, which is why a worse man cannot harm a better man. Unless you can make me do something evil, unless you can make me choose evil, you can't really harm me. You can beat me up, you can kill me, you can make me feel terrible, but you can't actually harm me, because I am not my body. I am not even really my mind. I am my soul. And the soul, we'll talk about this more in a second, is not like some magical thing that survives death and then goes up into the clouds to be with Jesus or anything like that. At least not in this particular context. The soul is something else, and we'll talk about it more here in a second. For the time being, Clandestine, here. So you got a bunch of stuff you said. In Plato's dialogues, Socrates trolled the shit out of the man who was to defend him in trial. Are you talking about Euthyphro? Because Euthyphro wasn't really supposed to defend him. He kind of defended himself. That was like the whole point, was that he didn't hire any rhetors to train him on how to give his defense speech. But yes, he questioned everyone's sense of justice. And that's exactly what he talks about in his defense speech. He goes to everyone who says they're wise, everyone who says they know something, and questions them and keeps asking why, as you point out, until the other person's argument just broke down, right? And then Public Citizen says it is an effective debate tactic, which it is an effective debate tactic, but that's not what Socrates was doing. Because think about it like this. If I showed up to somewhere where, let's say I showed up to your workplace, right? And I'm playing Socrates in this little hypothetical scenario here. And I come up to you and you're hard at work there. And I go, hey, how come you're doing it that way instead of that way? And the way I point out makes a lot more sense. And you kind of get frustrated, like, hey, man, I know what I'm doing. Leave me alone. Now, multiply that times 10,000, and that's what Socrates was doing to everyone. So, and then he corrupted the youth by teaching kids to backtalk adults. That's hilarious. I don't know if backtalk is the right word, but definitely taught the youth to question their elders, because he didn't have a ton of respect for hierarchy, or at least received hierarchy. He thought maybe a more meritocratic situation, right? That's actually why nowadays, and there's a group of people who are like socialists and radical Democrats, not big D party Democrats, people who are radical believers in democracy. And if they've read their Socrates, if they've read their Plato and their Xenophon talking about Socrates, they do not like Socrates. They call him a monarchist and like a reactionary, because he didn't really believe in democracy. Because they asked him who should rule the state. And he said, well, if you're sick, you go to an expert in sickness, a doctor. If your horse has a broken leg, you go to an expert in horses. So who should run the state? The experts in running the state, people who've studied the running of states. That, he said, makes the most sense. And he had very little time for the ultra-democratic mob. Now, that's not to say he believed in repression or anything like that. But he, for example, I was arguing with this guy on Twitter about voting ages. I said we should raise the voting age to 27 because that's when the prefrontal cortex finishes developing. And the person came back and they made a bunch of arguments. And then they said, you know, more democracy is always better. The answer is almost always more democracy, not less. And so somebody like Socrates is making the opposite argument. He's saying, in general, more democracy is more dangerous. And there's a perfectly good explanation for why he might think this, right? We've all seen how democratic societies end up voting in authoritarian governments. Europe in the 1930s is a great example. Romania, Italy, Germany, nowadays in Hungary and Turkey, these are democratically elected people, but they're also highly repressive. They're not people who we would confuse with just and virtuous men. Viktor Orban and Erdogan, whose name I never say right, but the guys in Hungary and Turkey, respectively, these are people we all can look at and say these are really repressive people. But they were legitimately democratically elected. So democracy is not always great. Sometimes democracy leads to some terrible stuff, right? And as Clandestine says, don't forget the United States. Well, talking about the United States in this context is more difficult because there might be, I don't know if there are, but there might be some fans of Joe Biden watching this. And then I don't want to confuse the point. But yes, the United States can also be a great example. And if you are a Biden supporter, then just look at Trump. Hey, he was democratically elected, or at least elected under our version of not quite democracy. So, and then Public Citizen says, no, age 11. I've been convinced. I got a guy that talks a good game, but first you have to pass an IQ test designed by me. Okay. Sounds to me like you've been spending some time with that anarchist anti-adult supremacy guy you were talking about, who you never helped me contact, so I got no time for this because I don't understand the position. I need to interview this anti-adult supremacist if I'm really going to take that position seriously. And dude, are you really bringing up IQ tests? Don't you know that IQ tests are super racist? Well, maybe not super racist, but they definitely have a history of being associated with eugenicists and racists in the past. But anyway, so point being, we came here to talk about undergoing suffering. And Socrates says losing honor, losing wealth, physical pain, the opprobrium of the crowds, none of it matters. What matters is the integrity of my soul. And I said that I would explain what he means by soul. And in order to do that, I want to tell a story. And this story comes to us from the Gnostics, the Gnostic Christians of the first 3 centuries Anno Domini, the first 3 centuries after Jesus Christ. The Gnostic Christians were mostly famous for the Gospel of Thomas that was discovered at the Nag Hammadi Library, I think in Egypt, in 1946. They found this old vase, and they opened it up, and there was a bunch of scrolls inside, and somebody snapped it up and said, oh my God, this is the Gospel of Thomas, there's the Gospel of Judas and Mary Magdalene, the Apocalypse of Peter, all these books that got rejected from the Bible during the Nicene Council under Constantine. But the Gnostics, as time has gone on, and Elaine Pagels is the best person to read on this. She wrote the Gnostic Gospels. She didn't write the Gnostic Gospels. She wrote a book called the Gnostic Gospels. And these are mystical Christians. These are Christians who bring in a little Buddhism, a little mysticism, maybe a little Greek mythology. And they're not so interested in, like, doctrinal perfection. They're not so interested in whether the earth is really 6,000 years old. What they're interested in is drawing out the mystical meaning from the texts. And they use them as tools to practice mysticism, to achieve gnosis, for which their movement is named, i.e. direct contact with God. And so after reading the Gnostics and kind of studying them and how they read stuff, I go back and I read from Genesis, from the regular Bible. And in Genesis, there's a line where it says that God gave to Adam to name the animals. Now, of course, you can take the literal meaning of that and you can say, oh, Adam, the first man, whose name means just man, made up the first language. Okay, fair enough. There's a mystical meaning as well. God gave to Adam to name the animals. God gave to Adam the power to look at circumstances, the power to look at the outside world and decide what to call them. This is the same wisdom that's encased in the saying, and I think this is like an apocryphal saying. I don't know that this is actually true, but it's said, I think Eckhart Tolle said this, that the Chinese character for crisis is two characters smushed together, and one of them means like catastrophe or disaster. The other one means opportunity. So I can be in a situation which you might call a crisis, and I might look at it and say, no, 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 this is an opportunity. That's me exercising my God-given right that God gave to Adam to name the animals. It's me exercising my ability to look at the same situation and call it something else. And so the soul is that which names the animals. The soul is that which chooses. The soul is that which takes the raw data of experience and converts them into a subjective, meaningful life, a subjective, meaningful narrative. That is what the soul really is. It is that which says, I am. Cogito ergo sum. Not I think, therefore I am, just I am. That is what Socrates says matters. The integrity of that, the integrity of my choices, is what matters. Not seeking after honor or popularity, right? You can all imagine somebody who really seeks after popularity or honor in this regard. That would be somebody like a TikTok star. Somebody whose life and selfhood and sense of meaning and importance and value in the world is wrapped up in the fact that they have 20 million people who hang on their every word and like their newest video. What happens when that person is canceled? They've lost their selfhood. They've lost their sense of meaning, their sense of importance in the world. You can, in other words, control such a person by threatening to take away that thing which gives their life meaning and value. threaten to take away their followers, and they will grovel and they will cave. But was it John Cena who accidentally called Taiwan a country? And then he came out later and gave this profuse apology, far more profuse than makes any sense for somebody like him. Why would John Cena, who's a professional guy who beats people up, have such deep feelings about offending the Communist Party of China by calling Taiwan a country, which is a contested issue, by the way? The reason being is that there was someone, somewhere, some interested party threatened to tarnish his reputation, to take away his honor in public, unless he caved to their demands. And being a person who was more interested in maintaining that public honor, that public popularity, that reputation, than he was someone who cared about his own virtue and saying what he truly believed, he could be broken and he could be controlled. And so, I've been interviewing a lot of libertarians on this show. On Tuesday, I had an anarchist on the show, Shane Hazel. And I've been kind of reading about anarchism and interested in it, but there's one thing I can't get away from. And it's germane right here, right now. And it's this. If I'm an anarchist, then I say, oh, there should be no control over people. People should freely choose what they want to do. And I think to myself, yeah, but the government is not the only thing preventing people from doing what they want to do. I, in my own life, struggle most not against the government, with which, frankly, I rarely interact, but rather with myself. My own addictions and desires and need to be popular, those are the things I struggle with the most. Those are the things, those are the forces that can most easily and quickly enslave me. And so, yeah, that's great. Let's talk about politics and the government. It's fun to talk about who's the good guy and who's the bad guy between the Democrats and the Republicans and decide how the state's going to be administered. But let us not forget in so doing that, as George Orwell said, the line between good and evil cuts through the human heart. Not between Republican and Democrat. Not even between communist and libertarian or anarchist. The government is not the main thing standing between you and liberty. The main thing standing between you and liberty is you. As long as what you really want out of life is honor, popularity, followers, whatever. The approval of the Chinese Communist Party. Whatever. Wiznoto, I don't know how to say your name. It said, is he the guy who said, take the path less taken? No, that was Robert Frost, the poet, to walk the road less traveled, I think is the... Or you might be talking about Ralph Waldo Emerson, who the teacher of Thoreau. I was going to include a quote from Thoreau in here, actually, but I didn't get around to making it. So... Dan Stewart says, I like these segments, but I like the meditations most of all. I really enjoy the breadth and depth of your knowledge of the philosophic subjects. I, too, enjoy the philosophic subjects, and thank you for the compliment. So, most politics is a mental game we have with ourselves, says Public Citizen. Yes, most of the time it is. And in fact, I would say most of the conflicts we experience in life is a mental game we have with ourselves. Alice C. says, John Cena's Chinese speaking skills are pretty good. Really? That is, frankly, shocking. And I like the passion in this episode. Yeah, actually, because, like I said, I was really not feeling it this morning. And then it turned into this meditation, and then I got really excited, like, oh my God, this is going to be cool. So, moving on, slightly. So, from honor, there's also wealth. Right? Money doesn't buy happiness. We've all heard that. The Beatles told us that. So, but unfortunately, and we're going to talk more about this in a second, 88% of the world corporations, their largest stakeholder is one of three financial companies. State Street, Vanguard, and then one other one. I forget the name of it. Blackwater. BlackRock. One's a mercenary company, one's a hedge fund. I don't remember which one's which. But anyway... Point being, there's all kinds of gatekeepers around wealth. Anybody who was trading GameStop on Robinhood knows how easily one's wealth can be taken away or messed with by forces outside of their control. We're going to talk a little bit about a cashless society later on in this episode. And in a cashless society, one without Bitcoin, right? Or my money's in a bank and all my transactions are digital. The government can seize my money at any moment with the touch of a button. I need perhaps be merely accused of being a drug dealer. And the government can seize my money and say, this is civil asset forfeiture. This money was earned using drugs. You can't use any of it to defend yourself. And then frame me for being a drug dealer and throw me into prison. And my reputation's destroyed. My freedom is gone. My money is taken away from me. If my sense of meaning, if my value as a human being, when I look in the mirror, is measured in dollars and cents, then they have, in so doing, taken away my selfhood. They have killed me. They have negated me. And now, instead of being a slave to the mob so they'll continue to watch my TikTok videos, now I'm a slave to some central banker somewhere with a computer who can adjust my worth by adjusting the amount of money in my bank account. And that brings me to happiness. There was that, I think it was Time Magazine had a cover, and I said, this is the issue that's all about happiness. And they say that the millennials, the reason that millennials have less wealth than their parents and grandparents at the same age is because millennials are more likely to spend their money on experiences. They're more likely to pursue happiness than to pursue, or I suppose we're, I am one, more likely to pursue happiness than to pursue wealth. And that's supposed to be some great transition. That's supposed to be a sign that humanity is advancing or something. But happiness is not a laudable goal. Happiness doesn't, it's not something I can pursue. The reason is, if I pursue happiness, I'm walking around all the time going, oh, is this making me happy? Is this making me happy? And that's a fundamentally flawed, a fundamentally fallacious way to look at the world. Because circumstances don't make me happy. Circumstances might give me pleasure. Eating a greasy hamburger might give me pleasure, but it doesn't make me happy. No, circumstances do not make people happy. People make circumstances happy. By their decisions about it, by exercising that mystical power to name things, to take the undifferentiated raw experience, raw data of experience, and turn it into a subjective, meaningful narrative. That is my power as a human being. It's something the government can't take away from me. It's something that you can't take away from me. It's something that a guy with a gun can't take away from me. Nobody can take it away from me. It is my kind of sacred right, my sacred birthright. And I don't have a lot of other birthrights. So there's this story told by Lucius Annaeus Seneca, one of the Stoic philosophers. And Seneca says there was this young Spartan boy, right? We remember Sparta from the movie 300. They didn't all have, sprayed on abs, but they did have a reputation for being the toughest dudes in the Peloponnese in the 500s BC. But the young Spartan boy was captured in battle, which was a huge dishonor. He should have died instead of being captured. But that's neither here nor there. So he was captured and he's sold into slavery. Right. And he gets to his new master, and his new master, as Seneca says, told him to go do some chore, to fetch a chamber pot, like clean the toilets. Right. That was the 500s BC equivalent of clean the toilets. And the Spartan said, I refuse to be a slave. And he dashed his head against a stone wall that he was standing next to, and he died. And to Seneca's mind, and frankly, to my mind as well, this guy is a hero. This guy lived out the truth that Socrates enunciated in the Apology. He said, you can hurt me, you can beat me, you can take away my liberty, but you cannot harm me. You cannot do me any real harm. For ultimately, the power of choice rests with me. And that Spartan boy said, given the choice between being a slave and dying, I will take dying. And killed himself on the spot. And in that case, the better man, the young Spartan boy who'd been captured and sold into slavery, could not be enslaved by the worse man because his will could not be broken. He maintained that power of choice, regardless of what shackles were placed on his body. And they tried to place shackles on his soul, his power of choice, and he said, no, He said, I'd choose to die instead. And so, unto the very end, he maintains his, ultimately, his liberty. Even in chains, even in slavery, still he had freedom. And that's a very key idea. But, of course, and Public Citizen says, eat another hamburger, you'll be happy eventually. I am scared of that strategy because I will grow. And I've got this image here framed just right. Right, with the picture behind me, and I don't want to have to readjust when I gain 60 pounds from eating hamburger after hamburger in the pursuit of happiness. Plus, I'd rather make videos about Socrates than about which kind of hamburger is best. I feel like other people already have those channels locked down, the food tasting channels. Not really my thing. So, anyway, that brings me to circumstances. Circumstances and justice. And the reason this is on my mind is because I've been reading Alex Vitale's The End of Policing. It kind of fit in with the whole examining anarchism and libertarianism thing. And Alex Vitale, gotta say, sociologist, some university or Brooklyn College or Brooklyn University, something like that. But anyway, sharp guy, great critique of policing. Some of his solutions leave a little bit to be desired. I saw an interview with him where he was in the same breath talking about we have to abolish, not defund, abolish the police and enact more gun control. To my way of thinking, that makes no sense because who's going to enforce the gun control if you get rid of the police, right? What's to stop me as a gun manufacturer from handing out free firearms every Tuesday, you know, free handgun with purchase of a shotgun to whoever wants one, if I know that no one's going to get me in trouble for it, right? And we saw that gun manufacturer, well, maybe you didn't. I saw it in the vast trove of data that I go through to make these episodes. I think it was the Gateway Pundit. Yes, I do periodically read the Gateway Pundit. Don't judge me. But they had a story about a guy who runs some gun shop called Phoenix Ammunition, and he had online gun sales. And if you go to the Phoenix Ammunition website, it's F-E-N-I-X. The first thing that comes up is a page that says, did you vote for Joe Biden? And if you click no, it takes you to the firearm manufacturer's website. If you click yes, it takes you to Joe Biden's website and his plan for gun control. So somebody, some guy, went to this website and ordered ammunition and put a note in with his order that said, hey, by the way, I did vote for Joe Biden. So the gun manufacturer came back and said, did you really just, I'm just confirming, you really did vote for Joe Biden? And the person said, yes, I did. And so the ammunition people canceled his order and sent him a thing that said, we're not going to do business with you because we refuse to do business with anybody who hates gun rights. So you take away the police, who's going to keep people like that from selling guns to whoever wants one, right? But anyway, not here to get sidetracked on that. I'm here to talk about circumstances and justice and what to do when circumstances suck. So, Alex Vitale in his book tells a story. And in that story feature the Texas Rangers. The Texas Rangers are a group of people who were at first just militia. Or actually, let me just, I've got a segment from the book here. I'm just going to read this. This is from Alex Vitale, The End of Policing. Quote, the U.S. had its own brand of colonial policing, the Texas Rangers. Initially, a loose band of irregulars, the Rangers were hired to protect the interests of newly arriving white colonists, first under the Mexican government, later under an independent Republic of Texas. Their main work was to hunt down native populations accused of attacking white settlers, as well as investigating crimes like cattle rustling. The Rangers also frequently acted as vigilantes on behalf of whites in dispute with the Spanish and Mexican populations. For more than a century, they were a major force for white colonial expansion, pushing out Mexicans through violence, intimidation, and political interference. In some cases, whites would raid cattle from Mexican ranches, and then, when Mexican vaqueros tried to steal them back, they would call in the Rangers to retrieve their stolen property. Mexicans and Native Americans who resisted Ranger authority could be killed, beaten, arrested, or intimidated. Mike Cox describes this as nothing short of an extermination campaign in which almost the entire indigenous population was killed or driven out of the territory. Kerrigan and Webb's Forgotten Dead, Mob Violence Against Mexicans in the United States, 1848 to 1928, is part of an effort involving families, academics, and the larger Tejano community to uncover this hidden history that culminated in an exhibit at the Bullock State History Museum, entitled Life and Death on the Border, which chronicled the many abuses of Texans of Mexican heritage who were pushed out by white settlers with the help of Texas Rangers. This includes the horrific 1918 massacre at Porvenir, in which Rangers killed 15 unarmed locals and drove the remaining community into Mexico for fear of further violence. This led to a series of state legislative hearings in 1919 about extrajudicial killings and racially motivated brutality on behalf of white ranchers. Those hearings resulted in no formal charges, and the graphic records of abuse were sealed for the next 50 years to prevent any stain on the Rangers' heroic record. Now, we like to pretend, we like to believe, that there's some sort of justice in the universe. We like to imagine that somehow happy endings are a real thing. But they are every bit as imaginary as Santa Claus. Not everybody gets their happy ending. All too often, the unjust prosper while the just languish. So, a little bit of a story here. Jordan Peterson actually tells the story of a study done on rats. He likes talking about rats and lobsters and that kind of stuff. In this study, they found that they put two rats in a cage, right? And the rats will play with each other as they'll be buddies, right? And if you put a rat in a cage with another rat and the one rat is 10% bigger than the other one, then the bigger rat can beat the littler rat in any game they play every single time. But if the bigger rat doesn't let the little rat win at least 30% of the time, the little rat will lose interest in playing with the bigger rat. It's no fun to play with you because you always win, right? Those of us who play chess are familiar with this. You lose too many games in a row and suddenly the game is not interesting anymore. Same also goes if you win every game, but we're not here to talk about that. So here's the point. Rat justice looks like the bigger rat letting the little rat win 30% of the time. It's an evolved thing that allows rats to play with each other. Human justice, likewise, is kind of a thing that we create when we need it and discard when we don't. It's useful, but to pretend that it corresponds to some kind of universal reality, to pretend that it corresponds to some kind of cosmic truth, is just the height of silliness. It doesn't make any sense because there's nothing out there acting as judge and juror. I mean, unless you are a old school Christian who believes it'll all be sorted out in the end, just wait until you die. God has a great sorting machine in the sky that's going to take all the Texas Rangers who hurt Mexican vaqueros and all the big rats who didn't let little rats win at least 30% of the time, and he's going to sort them. He's going to take them and he's going to put them in hell. Or purgatory, depending on what year it is and what sect you are. But as somebody who doesn't practice Christianity, I can't say I believe in that. And I don't know what happens after death. I certainly can't pretend to know more than Socrates, because then I know he'll rise from the grave and come call me out for pretending to know things that I don't. But the history of justice among humans, frankly, is the history of what's convenient for the powerful, to be created in one moment and discarded in another. And Public Citizen says, it sounds like it's time to cancel Chuck Norris. Where are my reparations? My forefathers provided this land, Aztlan, to me. Well, everybody's forefathers provided their land to them. The problem is everybody's forefathers stole their land from somebody else's forefathers. In no way is this limited to Rangers and Vaqueros, right? You think that's bad? Go read the history of Europe. It's just as bad. Same thing in Asia. So right now, the Han Chinese are the dominant force in China because they did similar things to all the other people living in China before them. Once upon a time, there were Siberians who had moved down into China. So China, at least northwestern China, was full of people with blonde hair and blue eyes, but they are gone because they were pushed out. Also partially because the climate changed, but that's a different topic for a different show. So what are we supposed to do about this sort of thing? Are we just going to go, oh, let's go enact justice. Let's go execute some Texas Rangers, right? And get back at them for all the wrong they did. Or let's have reparations. Let's give out money to people who are descendants of those vaqueros, if we can find them. But we know from history that as soon as the people who like the Texas Rangers more than the vaqueros, who tell some other story about all the injustices done to white settlers by Mexican vaqueros, are again in power, they will reverse all of that stuff. Any vengeance we try to take, that we dress up as justice, will just be visited back upon us the next time they have enough power to do so. And before you know it, we're like Hatfields and McCoys, perpetually at war with each other, both sides claiming justice, and nobody remembering what we're actually fighting about. So what should I do? Should I just abandon all justice? Forget about right and wrong. Just go get what's mine, right? Well, I suppose I could do that, right? I could try to make sure that when history is written, I am the Texas Ranger and not the vaquero. I can try to make sure that I am the big rat and not the little rat, right? But that brings us back to Socrates. What if my wealth is frozen by the government? What if I lose my honor? What if they open up the records of those Texas Rangers 50 years later, right? So in 1969, what happens when they open up the records of my injustices and misdeeds? And all the stuff that I've gained has been taken from me. Now I have nothing. Not even the comfort of knowing that I did the right thing by my own standards. I did what it took to get ahead. And so when I'm no longer ahead, now I have nothing. Now I really know what it means to be in hell. If I've built my life on being rich or being popular or whatever, I will ultimately, because I've spent my time seeking after things that are pleasurable instead of things that are just, if I've spent my time running away from suffering, then ultimately, when I come to death, I will be afraid. I will die the coward's death in agony and terror, not the hero's death, not the death that Socrates died or that Jesus died, going into death knowing why they were doing it. I think it was Shakespeare who said, "The coward dies a thousand times, the hero dies but once." Dan Stewart said, "Only if the vaqueros make the indigenous people right, and they do right to the Clovis peoples." Yeah, that's exactly the point I'm making. Everybody's forefathers stole their land from everybody else's forefathers. Trying to enact justice in the world, trying to use the force of government or guns or moral rectitude to try and coerce people into making up for the wrongs of the past is a fool's errand. It's not going to work. You're just going to create more injustice somewhere. And Sibri makes a good point. It almost always makes things worse, right? Like, everybody thought that they were doing good in the world. No one, Adolf Hitler himself, didn't wake up in the morning and said, "I can't wait to go do some evil today," right? He woke up and said, "I'm going to go save the world." But then if you read Viktor Frankl, one of his victims, write about what went on in Auschwitz, there's actually a little story in there that Frankl tells. And Viktor Frankl, by the way, if you don't know, wrote Man's Search for Meaning. He was an Austrian psychiatrist, also Jewish, who ended up in a concentration camp for several years during World War II. But he survived against all odds and went on to return to psychiatry. He became a world-renowned psychiatrist because, you know, can you imagine going to somebody and being like, "Well, my mom was really controlling," and then you realize that the guy therapizing you was in the Holocaust? I don't know. That might make it hard for me to talk about my problems. But he was the one who would famously ask his patients, "So with all these problems you have, why don't you just kill yourself?" And of course, he wasn't telling them to kill themselves. He was waiting for them to be like, well, I can't kill myself because what about my daughter? What about this great talent I have for playing the cello? I got to use this before I die. And then Franco would go, ah, yes. Okay, now we know why you're doing what you do. Now we know the purpose for your life. And he said that he developed that from his time in the Holocaust, from looking at himself, because a lot of people didn't survive the Holocaust. Some of them didn't survive because they were selected for the gas chamber. Those are not the ones I'm talking about. The ones I'm talking about now are the ones who didn't survive because they killed themselves on seeing where they had been taken and realizing that there was no way out and not knowing that World War II would be over in a few years and there would be Americans and Russians coming to liberate them sooner or later. They thought this was it, and so they just threw themselves on the electric wire and died. Others, though, and this is the story, he said there were some people in the camps who made a habit of giving away their food to other people. Because they were given so little food, some people, like they, and these were generally like younger, stronger people who felt like the weight of responsibility for trying to carry the community, these people would often give away their food to like suffering old ladies or sick people or whatever. And there's a famous line in Man's Search for Meaning where Frankel tells this story, and at the end of it, he says, the best of us did not return. And Frankel goes on to explain how those who did make it were those who were willing to do anything to survive, who would gladly turn in the guy next to him for an extra piece of bread. And he had to like come to terms with some of the stuff that he did in the camps in order to survive. But point being that those people who chose to give away their food and so died, there's a couple ways to look at it, right? We can go, oh, how horrible. We must never let this happen again. That's great. There's another way. That other way is to say, isn't it interesting that those people who chose to do what they considered virtuous, regardless of circumstance or suffering in their own, in and of themselves, those people didn't suffer through the Holocaust. They died. And they left the planet, or they left this life, or they left this earth, right? Whatever's in the afterlife, surely they're going to get some kind of reward, right? Unless, of course, we all die and it turns out that God is a Nazi sympathizer, which, just like promises of Christian hell, seems to me extraordinarily unlikely. So I can only imagine that those people went on to something better. They were spared the horror. And so, well, the justice in the universe... Well, there's definitely no human justice in the universe. There is a kind of justice. Just one that doesn't always make sense to us. And so when I say that there's justice in the universe, it doesn't mean that good things happen to good people by the standards of humanity, or that bad things happen to bad people by the standards of humanity. I think the justice in the universe is that gift that was given to Adam in the book of Genesis. And the mystical meaning thereof, the gift to name the animals, the promise that I can take the circumstances that I'm in and I can name them. I can take the circumstance of being in Auschwitz, being in the Holocaust, and say, this is an opportunity for me to do some good in the world, and then do it. Those people who gave away their food did some good in the world. They didn't look at where they were as the worst thing in the world, and I'd better turn in the guy next to me to survive. I'm going to do something virtuous. Frankel also did something virtuous. By surviving, by turning in the guy next to him so that he could get an extra piece of bread, so that he could go on to write Man's Search for Meaning, so that he could go on to therapize people and help people who were suffering, who were suicidal, and take them out of their own suffering by using his own suffering as a way to help them out of it. And that is the justice in the universe. That is the sacred power that I have. To come here today and say, hey, I got no guests, no Bianca, and not feeling great today with my neck, and I didn't sleep and all this. So what is this? What is this? Why is the universe doing this to me? When? I can look at that and I can rename it. And I can say, you know what? This is an opportunity to work on a part of this show that I've been neglecting, which is the solo part, the part where it's just me and you guys here in this intimate fireside setting with my painting and my typewriter behind me talking about philosophy, which is awesome.